Thank you for joining us. Welcome to our live presentation on Coradi Radio. Today is Saturday, May 18th, 2019. Our guest today, Carly Samish, will be sharing a talk titled The Mysterious Path of the Bodhisattva. We'd like to encourage all of you to send us your questions and comments to our email, coradiradio@gmail.com, and we will go to a Q&A and answer your questions. And now, without further ado, we welcome Carly Samish to Coradi Radio.
All right. Thank you. Hi, everybody. Thanks for listening today, either on the live broadcast or on the recording later on. So yeah, we'll just get into it. So I want to go over the teachings as I understand it about the Bodhisattva. And this is, of course, a really vast topic, but there's some things I want to touch on. I want to talk about the definition of the Bodhisattva from Samael and Vior, Master Samael, because of course it's also part of the Buddhist tradition as well. And we'll talk about the fallen Bodhisattva, the Hanusmushin, and then I'll be reading a little bit from a traditional text called The Way of the Bodhisattva by Shantideva, and reflections on what all this means for our work. And as Annabelle said, if you have questions, you can go ahead and contact Coradi Radio, and I'll do my best to address them at the end here. Okay, so first, Samael talked a lot about the Bodhisattva, mentioned it in various books, and this one quote from The Major Mysteries kind of sums up a lot of what I'm going to be talking about. He says, "We, the Bodhisattvas of compassion, who love humanity immensely, state, as long as there is a single tear in any human eye, as long as there is even one suffering heart, we refuse to accept the happiness of nirvana. We must seek the means to become more and more useful to this wretched, suffering humanity." So that is really the essence of the Bodhisattva. And I'll continue to expand on this. And then I'm also going to start as well with a dedication. And this is part of the last chapter from The Way of the Bodhisattva by Shantideva, who's an Indian saint or sage, who's a master. And I believe he was teaching in Tibet or teaching to the Tibetan Buddhism, and wrote this wonderful book, The Way of the Bodhisattva. And the last chapter is the dedication, and it's the accumulation of all the chapters that have come before it, which is different teachings, different practices, and different reflections on what it means to work on this way of the Bodhisattva. So in this dedication, he says, "Through the virtue of having composed this work, A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, may all living beings come to engage in the Bodhisattva's conduct. May all beings everywhere, plagued with sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. For as long as they remain in cyclic existence, may their mundane happiness never decline, and may all of them uninterruptedly receive waves of joy from bodhisattvas. May all embodied creatures who throughout the universe experience hellish realms come to enjoy the bliss of Sukhavati. May those feeble with cold find warmth, and may those oppressed with heat be cooled by the boundless waters that pour forth from the great clouds of the Bodhisattva's merits. May the forest of razor-sharp leaves become a beautiful pleasure grove, and may the trees of knives and swords grow into wish-fulfilling trees. May the regions of hell become places of joy with vast and fragrant lotus pools, beautified with the exquisite calls of wild ducks, geese, and swans. May the heaps of burning coals change into heaps of jewels. May the burning ground become a polished crystal floor, and may the mountains of the crushing hells become celestial palaces of worship filled with sugatas. May the rains of lava, blazing stones, and weapons from now on become a rain of flowers, and may all battling with weapons from now on be a playful exchange of flowers." Okay, so that's the beginning of our dedication here. So this really is that spirit of the Bodhisattva, which is the prayer and the dedications for all beings to be happy, with also that wisdom to know what's necessary to achieve that happiness for all beings and the willingness to do the work that's necessary to achieve that. So just thinking about, you know, in our work, wherever we are with this process, with Gnosis, and just reflecting on why would someone work, you know, this Bodhisattva work through countless lifetimes achieving enlightenment, only to renounce the reward of being able to leave the wheel of suffering. So, you know, sometimes we want to ask ourselves kind of what is the motivation? Is there some motivation in our spiritual process or spiritual path to essentially kind of escape the world, this world that has so much violence and war and pain and ugliness, corruption, and so forth. And, you know, what is our aim? What is the maybe hidden motivation in our process here? And I know that the Gnostic path, it brings a lot of ordeals and we're continually having to face ourselves. And sometimes after a while, it feels like we're getting further away from an idea of enlightenment that we had of what it's supposed to look like or what it's supposed to feel like. What's really useful is coming to a place where we can work in a disinterested way. We still have our full efforts and our full attention in the work, but there's not even a subtle attachment to a goal or to whatever that nirvana is for us in that moment, because the work doesn't really end. We don't really get to achieve a certain point and then just kind of rest on the cloud, rest on our laurels. The work changes, but we're always having to renew it and to re-examine it and to re-examine our motivations. In my time in Gnosis, I've really had to look and face some of these realities and admit to myself that I had external motivations, of course, mixed in with sincere internal yearnings, but, you know, wanting, we can look at this for ourselves, but I know for myself, wanting to feel special, wanting to feel like I belong somewhere, that I'm a part of something spiritual or different, that I have a spiritual lifestyle, that people will perceive me a certain way, that I'll have idealized relationships, or even just wanting to feel good, like feel in a state of bliss or something like that after a meditation practice. So certainly these are things that can happen and do happen in this kind of work because we're maturing psychologically and we're growing spiritually. But it's good to extract and pull out and shine a light on if these are purely hidden motivations that drive our work. And then if we are not kind of getting these kinds of little rewards, little nirvanas, then we like flounder or struggle in the work. And so going back to this idea of the bodhisattva who's, you know, sacrificed everything, essentially is like a Buddha on earth in a way and done, you know, achieved a very specific level of spiritual attainment and are just sticking around and just wanting to help all beings. So it's really inspiring. So one thing too is the reality with, you know, some of these things I listed, feeling good, feeling better, feeling, you know, feeling like we belong. These things may arrive and they may exist and they may be a part of the motivation in our work, but then they also leave. Like it's fleeting, even feeling good after meditation, feeling silence of the mind, feeling at peace, feeling good after a retreat. It's present, it's real, and then it also is temporary often. So just trying to go a little bit deeper and the understanding of the path of the bodhisattva, really knowing this is crucial because ultimately it's a Christic kind of work. You know, bodhisattva is that Buddhist term, but it's a Christic path because the Christic path is about sacrifice with love for love of others and the love of God. And it takes place within the world. So to be motivated purely by being within the universal flow of life, like just fulfilling this requirement that the universal flow of life is, means to do this kind of Christic work, to sacrifice ourselves for others. And the other way to be selfish is ultimately going to lead to a kind of materialism. And I'll expand on that more in a little bit, just to say. And then also the path of the bodhisattva in particular resonates with our fourth way teachings. And we know that's just a basic foundation of understanding of our Gnostic path, that we do the work in a balanced way in life. And we don't have that luxury of going away to a cave to reach our enlightenment. We're really in the mix in the world here and doing our work here and now. So if we have these teachings, if we have these tools, which, you know, if we're listening to this talk, we really do, we're in touch with the Gnostic teachings, we have these tools, we have the capability, then we really want to go back to our motivation to come from that imitation of Christ on the most fundamental level, to do God's will, praying to do God's will, if we don't know what that is, using our strengths not for our own benefit, even for our own spiritual progress in a way, but to always remember the purpose of this process, which I can best describe as being in the universal flow of life and fulfilling that duty. Okay, so the definition of the term bodhisattva from Buddhism, since it is a Buddhist term and we're using that term, I just want to define it. And of course, there's lots of ways to define it, but bodhi is usually translated as enlightened or wisdom, perfect knowledge. Sattva is essence or goodness, truth. So you could say that bodhisattva literally means essence of wisdom, but it also is that teaching of a being that has reached enlightenment, but renounces nirvana. And then in Gnosis, the Bodhisattva has a really specific term that we don't find in Buddhism. And it specifically says that basically the Bodhisattva is a human solar consciousness that's built the solar bodies. So in the Aquarian message, Samael says the Bodhisattva is the human soul of a master. The master is the internal God. So it's a certain level of development internally. The creation of the solar, astral, mental, and causal bodies, and then walking the direct path. So it's that particular combination that makes the Bodhisattva. So, you know, there's the spiral path, which is out of the scope of this talk for today, but those of us who are listening are probably familiar with the direct path, which is the path of working to pay all of our karma in one lifetime, to work on the three factors simultaneously in one lifetime, and to essentially renounce like temporary vacations in the higher dimensions to work on this Christic path. So it's very much the same thing, path of the Bodhisattva, direct path. So when we have the solar bodies, what that is they are vehicles. In Hebrew, it's the Merkabah, the chariot, the four solar bodies. And the vehicles strengthen the relationship and the communication with the being. So they're tools, they're vehicles, they're the result of work in sexual alchemy, either this lifetime or previous lifetimes, and they confer a certain center of gravity in the work and the path. And so this Bodhisattva is this being, this consciousness with these vehicles, with these tools, who is ideally on the path of actually awakening for good and not for evil, is going to be a messenger or a servant of their inner being or their inner Buddha. And in order to have created these solar bodies, we have to have gone through a transformation from a lunar human to a solar human, which is a deliberate and conscious effort done with the consistent work with sexual transmutation and sexual alchemy, ego death, and sacrificing ourselves for others. So being a Bodhisattva is something very specific. It's not just being a good person. It's not having good intentions, trying to do good blindly or unconsciously. It's not really about just kind of going around wanting to help people or to be nice to people. It's an actual, our organism has actually undergone actual psychological and spiritual transformations. And it gives more power, more direction, just more abilities to our essence rather than just being a spark of essence, a spark of consciousness, which of course is still light. It's still its own kind of power, but those vehicles really kind of solidify it in a way, strengthen it. Okay, so that's all just to say that Bodhisattva is really a title, a particular point in the internal initiatic process, and it's objective and doesn't really have anything to do with the personality. When it's an essence without the solar bodies, it's just an essence with the lunar bodies. So if the essence belongs to a monad or a being who wishes to enter into the path, then the essence or consciousness will generally be pushed into teachings to learn to awaken, to transmute, and to die in the ego, just as we are all trying to do with these teachings. And we're all here by virtue of our monad pushing us and arranging it so that we can come into contact with these teachings. And then, you know, hopefully we've just have had enough dharma as well to be able to make that possible and to be able to stay. The inner being or the Buddha resides in the superior worlds and sends this Bodhisattva into the lower worlds to work for others. So that monad who wants that process done, it's like sending your child off to school or something to be trained, to grow, to learn, to develop, to mature, as opposed to, I don't know how far to take this analogy, but like just keeping the child home and just, you know, not sending them out and just trying to keep them like a child forever. But that's also a mysterious aspect, like why a certain monad would want to have their essence reach self-realization and go through this process, and why another monad wouldn't. And that's just something that's very mysterious to me. I don't quite understand that, but if we're being pushed, we generally know it. And at that point, it's our duty, do our best to try to fulfill this duty to our being. Also with the solar bodies is they're vehicles, they're a means to an end. So it's at a certain point in the work, it's a goal to build the bodies, but it's not the entire goal of the entire work. Samael says that the bodies are actually dissolved at a certain point in the work too. So like I say, there's always work to be done, esoteric work to be done, and different parts of it, and it's always changing. So the bodies are just, it's just a vehicle, it's a tool, a spiritual tool, really important, really crucial, but not the ultimate goal. Now, another aspect of the Bodhisattva is having what is called bodhicitta. And again, this is a Buddhist term. Samael talked about it quite a bit, and it's very specifically the awakened consciousness that comes from the transmuted sexual energy. So there's even like translations of bodhicitta that mean that are related to the seed, which of course is the spiritual seed. And then in Gnosis, we understand that spiritual and sexual seed are the same thing. In the Pistis Sophia Unveiled, Samael says, the bodhicitta is the awakened and developed superlative consciousness of the being. The bodhicitta emerges in the aspirant who sacrifices himself for his fellow men long before the mercurial bodies have been created. It is necessary for the bodhicitta, which means the auric embryo, the awakened consciousness, to fall into the illuminated void. So we see that bodhicitta is much more than a quality. It's not a quality. It's not an intention. It's not, trying to be nice, intending to be compassionate. It really is the concrete result of actual work in transmuting the vital sexual energies. And another, again, in the Pisces Sophia, Samael says, obviously, before the bodhisattva is born, the bodhicitta must be formed within ourselves. Furthermore, it is important to clarify the necessity of disintegrating the ego, the I, in order for the bodhicitta to emerge. The bodhicitta is formed with the merits of love and supreme sacrifice for our fellow men. The bodhisattva is formed within the environment and psychological atmosphere of the bodhicitta. So this, like as I was saying earlier, that motivation to do this work and to continually sacrifice and to have that love that comes from the being to work for humanity, the bodhicitta makes that possible. The bodhicitta brings that light. It consolidates and coagulates that light within us. It's the transformative properties of the sexual energy and the awakened consciousness all working together so that the work is possible. If we don't have that resource, then we aren't really doing the work, or we're not able to do it in a sustainable way. So we have to have comprehension in order to have the bodhicitta. We have to have comprehension of ourselves in relation to the absolute, and to be able to die into the ego, because the ego will block ourselves from understanding the vastness of God and the reality of the absolute and that truth. And the ego will just not be able to grasp the necessity of sacrificing for humanity and to work for others, because the ego just wants to be comfortable, you know, it wants to be liked and cared for and all of that. So that we really have those experiences, even just for a moment without the ego, you know, just for a moment in meditation, and start to comprehend that requirement of love and sacrifice to be in alignment with that flow of universal life and fulfill that cosmic duty. Again, in the Pistis Sophia, Samael says, let it be understood that a bodhisattva is a seed, a germ, with the possibility of transcendental divine development by means of pressure coming from the height. And again, that's another way of just saying that monad, what, you know, is pushing the bodhisattva to awaken, to do this process. Samael also says, the alchemist who does not sacrifice himself for humanity will never become a bodhisattva. Only the bodhisattvas with compassionate hearts who have given their life for humanity can incarnate the intimate Christ. We must make a complete differentiation between the Sravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas on one side and the bodhisattvas on the other. The Sravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas preoccupy themselves only with their particular perfection, without caring a bit for this poor suffering humanity. Obviously, the Pratyeka Buddhas and Sravakas can never incarnate Christ. Only the Bodhisattvas who sacrifice themselves for humanity can incarnate Christ. The sacred title of Bodhisattva is legitimately attained only by those who have renounced all nirvanic happiness for the love of the suffering humanity. And in the Aquarian message, he says, the truly humble bodhisattva never praises himself. The humble bodhisattva says, I am just a miserable slug from the mud of the earth. I am a nobody. My person has no value. The work is what is worthy. The bodhisattva is the human soul of the master, and the master is the internal God. You know, this is really interesting. Like, I just remember, I mean, I'm still so impressed with this, but I remember first kind of coming into Gnosis and hearing these teachings about really specifically, like, what a Buddha is and what a Christ is, and then even different kinds of Buddhas and the different paths that a Buddha might take versus a bodhisattva. And it's just amazing. So, you know, to be a Buddha is, of course, a really magnificent achievement, to have no ego and to be enlightened, but it's still different than the work of the bodhisattva. And I think on some level, just with this path, I just think that on some level, we, whether we technically are or objectively are a bodhisattva, based on our building the solar bodies or not. I just think these teachings are so relevant on this path, just because the flavor of it is so Christic. And that's what we're really trying to do. And then a quote here from the 14th Dalai Lama, the current Dalai Lama. He says, "Bodhisattvas are beings who, out of intense compassion, never shift their attention away from sentient beings. They are perpetually concerned for the welfare of all beings, and they dedicate themselves entirely to securing their welfare. Thus, the very name Bodhisattva indicates a being who, through wisdom, heroically focuses on the attainment of enlightenment out of compassionate concern for all beings. The word itself conveys the key qualities of such an infinitely altruistic being." So I want to talk a little bit about just the mysterious aspect of this. So I call this talk the mysterious path of the Bodhisattva, in particular because the path of gnosis and awakening really means entering into a mystery. And it's just been interesting, the longer that I do this and the more that I learn, the more, I guess, mysterious it becomes. Not confusing exactly, but the more I'm kind of in awe of just the diversity of the way that different people's paths unfold and how I really don't know what the path is going to look like for myself or other people, and just the mystery of God, the mystery of the being, and the mystery of the consciousness, all these things. So it's good to kind of look at that and hold that, in particular because just talking about the Bodhisattva really highlights and shines light on this paradox, this paradoxical aspect that we have in gnosis. So when we're working, we grow our capacity for love, our love grows, and then that increases our capacity to hold sorrow and grief. We grow in strength, we grow in spiritual discipline, and then we feel smaller and less significant before God, before our being. The most simple thing, the more light we have of the consciousness, the more the darkness is revealed. And we're always having to work within this paradox, in this path. And, you know, we have this infinite being working within the finite. The being is infinite, God is infinite, and then the Bodhisattva, which is, you know, with the solar bodies, that solar, mental, astral, and causal aspect. If it's our essence, it's our lunar aspect, but still, like, you know, our monad is pushing us to really awake and come to know his perfection. And we are, by definition, imperfect. We are, by definition, finite and constrained by the material aspect. And we have to work within that. We don't get to kind of jump out of it and just, you know, bypass any of this process. So it's, and it can be a lot because we want to awake, we want to be free, we want to be happy, we want those around us to be happy, we want to have serenity and equilibrium, we don't want to make fools out of ourselves. And yet we're in, you know, the impossible situation, kind of the cosmic joke of material reality. And we need a lot of serenity to really be with that. We really need to have our practices and our transmutation and those moments, whether short or longer moments of no ego and no duality, to be able to move forward in an integrated way, to be at peace. So this path of the Bodhisattva is about comprehending the intimate being that is. He is. That is the definition of the being, is that which is. You know, here we are, the essence living in the mind, the will, and the motions and emotions that belong to the being. But as our ego is fortified and strengthened, then we sleep in those movement and activities of the thoughts, feeling, and action. So again, yeah, just it's that paradox. We're trying to awake, but we're asleep. We want to know, but we're ignorant. And we want that reality. And we just have to keep trying to awaken to it. Really love this quote. "I am not greater because they praise me, nor less because they scorn me," or they, he uses the word vituperate, "because I always am what I am." And that really is going to have to be, to a certain extent, like our mantra or our motto, working in the path of the Bodhisattva, live and breathe that truth. Like, it's just the work. And a lot of it is just putting one foot in front of the other in a relaxed way, of course, having serenity and finding that internal motivation, just because I am what I am, or we could say the being is what he is. And to the extent that we are connected to our being, we just know that truth more and more. So we learn to communicate with the being, learn to connect with the consciousness, of course, through our practices, our transmutation, our meditation, all those tools that we have, and accepting the imperfection of our situation, our own unique circumstances, our own unique lives and situations and everybody else's own unique imperfections. Because by definition, like I say, we're not perfect and we're not the being. And so there's always imbalances and always some suffering there. Okay, I have this really interesting quote from Samael Onvior, and it's called Visitors of a Bodhisattva. And it's kind of like a little glimpse into his life as a living master, you know, in his time when he was alive, doing the work of his being in a very profound way, in a very direct way, in a very clear way, and knowing the truth, teaching the truth, and yet living in a house with a family and, you know, dealing with people and all this. So I'm going to read part of this excerpt from this talk, Visitors of a Bodhisattva, from Samael. Beloved brothers and sisters of the Universal Gnostic Movement, Inferential Peace, in the name of truth, I want to emphatically tell you that I do not want to receive visitors. Unquestionably, I am nothing more than a postman, a courier, a man that delivers a message. It would be the breaking point of silliness for you to come from your country to the capital city of Mexico with the only purpose of visiting a vulgar postman, an employee that delivered you a letter in the past. Why would you waste your money for that? Why would you visit a simple courier, a miserable postman? It is better for you to study the message, the written teachings delivered in the books. Multiple are the intellective images of my varied visitors. Diverse are the forms of their mind. Some, when they think about the messenger, imagine him as being an exotic hermit of foregone times, similar to Palamon the Stylite, the successor of Anthony the Ancient. Others assume that he may be like a penitent old man carrying sackcloth of hair upon his flagellated body. Others fancy him as a venerable sage striding at all hours through the streets of Mexico while wearing a shining turban and a white tunic. Others picture me as a saint endlessly living among ignited wax candles and perfumed flowers within an indescribable sanctuary. However, the crude reality of the fact is that the messenger of the new era is an average, common, and ordinary citizen, a nobody, whose value is the lowest. Unquestionably, for these and many other reasons, it is a triviality of very bad taste to travel from distant lands in order to visit someone who is not worth the trouble. So go and visit the libraries, the archaeological museums, the ruins of Egypt, etc. That is indeed better. Okay, so I love that quote. I think there's like some humor in there. He's just like, I'm a normal person. I'm not this magical saint with a turban walking around always, you know, surrounded by ignited candles and beautiful flowers in a sanctuary. Like, I'm in a house, you know, trying to just live my life and pass on this message from my being. And so, you know, and of course, when he's saying he's a nobody's value is the lowest, it's not a shame thing. It's just like just a true thing. Like we in this work, we're personages that have just like a value for being like our own human respect for ourselves and all of that. But, you know, there certainly isn't anything special, you know, about us as a person in our lives. It's not about that. It's the work, it's the message. And we just let that speak for itself and also not stopping and also not just waiting to get to that nirvanic vacation when we can just kind of relax and stop the work. It's getting used to that and accustomed to that process and to really, you know, build that stamina to keep going. And accepting who we are and what we really are. So again, coming back to that paradox of the being is within us, the glorious being, you know, God, the infinite, and yet we're finite. The bodhisattva should really function as a servant to the being who's that inner master. So this is really a nice analogy is like the samurai of ancient Japan, that warrior class. And it was such that the warrior was completely and totally obedient to their master. And of course, that was like part of the social and economic structure and things like that. But from a spiritual perspective, it's really profound because the bodhisattva is like that samurai, highly trained, has weapons, has resources, is, you know, dedicated, focused, just highly, highly skilled, and yet has, you know, being completely obedient to the master. And that's going to be the highest function of that purpose. But when a bodhisattva goes astray, when either for whatever reason, their master, they disconnect from their master in some way for some reason, then they become a ronin, which is a masterless samurai. And that's where we get trouble. That's where we have this highly skilled individual with lots of weapons, or I guess maybe just the main weapon, the sword. But, you know, in either case, highly trained individual who can kill and defend and all of this without direction from that higher wisdom. And so that's what we have to be kind of careful about. Now, I also want to talk about this really interesting chapter called the Krishnamurti case, and it's from Samael's book, Endocrinology and Criminology. And really, this chapter, I'm so impressed by it. I was kind of into Krishnamurti like around the time I first got into Gnosis. And I don't know if people listening have read much Krishnamurti, but there was always this like really interesting kind of contradiction in his teachings. Like he gives really beautiful teachings. I mean, just reading it kind of invokes that sense of self-remembering and self-observation, just like, you know, like reading just any kind of master who's really speaking from their consciousness. And then at the same time, he kind of interjects all these teachings with, but there's no teacher, there's no path, there's no schools, I'm not a teacher, there's no organizations. And there was always like kind of this like confusion and unsettling to me, like, well, you're teaching, like, why aren't you a teacher? I'm receiving teachings from this. And then Samael explains it, but this is relevant to the Bodhisattva. So I'm going to kind of summarize some of this chapter and then read some of it. And again, this is from Endocrinology and Criminology. So Krishnamurti, okay, so he was born in 1895 and died in 1986. So he was around in that era. And he was kind of discovered by the Theosophical Society. And he was a young boy in India. And one of the members of this Theosophical Society, I believe it was Ledbetter, but it might have been Annie Besant, one of the people who first saw him just in India, and they perceived his aura, they perceived his internal aspect, and it was so profound. They saw his being, and they saw that it was at the level of like an awakened Buddha. And so they took him into the society and kind of groomed him to be the next Messiah, because based on their clairvoyance, they saw such a high level of being there that clearly, this person must be the next Messiah. But not everyone in the Theosophical Society agreed with that. Rudolf Steiner in particular said that, no, he's not the next Messiah. And so Krishnamurti as a person, but also as like a bodhisattva, like a mind and an emotion and a body, was being raised by people who were sort of fighting over whether or not he was the Messiah, which is very confusing very confusing psychologically. And Samael, in this book, Endocrinology and Criminology, where he's talking about psychological pathology, he says that it was a trauma, and it created a trauma within the bodhisattva aspect of Krishnamurti. And so he refused to step up to be to take on the order called the Order of the Eastern Star that the Theosophical Society made for him to be the head of, and he dissolved the organization. And he left, and he spent most of his time, he lived out the rest of his life in a small town in Southern California, and he gave teachings, he wrote many books, he gave talks, and they all just contained this amazing mix of just really, I mean, useful teachings and beautiful teachings and profound insights about self-observation and taking responsibility for your psychology and, you know, looking at ego, looking at projection, and then just a real staunch insistence that there just is no teachers and there is no path and there is no particular objective truth that could be had and an organization and things like that. And we know that without a teacher, without a teaching, a doctrine of some sort, we can't really find our way. So that's kind of the summary of it. So I'm just going to read what Master Samael has to say in the chapter. He says, in that epoch, a division occurred in the heart of the Theosophical Society. Some asserted that Krishnamurti was the Messiah. Others did not accept that concept. Thus, they withdrew from the Theosophical Society. And he goes on to say, we need to analyze the Krishnamurti case because it was a true tragedy. The most critical thing to see was those clairvoyants fighting amongst themselves. This is something that confuses the minds of those that are starting in these studies. Krishnamurti fell into skepticism. He remained skeptical for many years. Yet finally, he responded and started his mission. All of us, the endoteric Gnostic brothers and sisters, proposed ourselves to investigate the Krishnamurti case in the superior worlds. After many patient works, we arrived at the following conclusions. First, every human being is a trio of body, soul, and spirit. Second, when the spirit defeats matter, it becomes a Buddha. Third, when the soul purifies and sanctifies itself, then it is called a bodhisattva. Fourth, the spirit of Krishnamurti is a Buddha. Fifth, the soul of Krishnamurti is a bodhisattva. There are many Buddhas in Asia who have not incarnated the Christ yet. There is a ray within every human being that unites us to the Absolute. The ray is our resplendent dragon of wisdom, the internal Christ, the Sephirotic crown. The Buddhas who have not yet incarnated the internal Christ have not Christified themselves yet. Krishnamurti's Buddha had already incarnated his resplendent dragon of wisdom, his particular ray, his own internal Christ. When the theosophists studied the Krishnamurti case, they became astonished with the splendid light of that Christified Buddha. However, since they did not know the Christic esotericism, they completely believed that Krishnamurti was the reincarnation of Jesus Christ. The mistake was not in their clairvoyance. The mistake was in their lack of intellectual culture. They only knew about the theosophical septenary. They only knew about the body, soul, and spirit. Yet they ignored that beyond these three aspects of the body, soul, and spirit, every human being has a ray, the internal Christ, that unites us to the absolute. They saw the internal God of Krishnamurti and believed that he was Jesus of Nazareth. That was their mistake. What is most critical is the damage that they perpetrated upon the Hindu boy. When a bodhisattva is told that his internal God is a master, he becomes confused. He is damaged. He develops a complex. The Hindu boy saw those instructors arguing among themselves because of him. Thus, the outcome was a psychological trauma for his human personality. Krishnamurti had a psychological trauma. There is no doubt that the theosophist clairvoyance did great damage to the Hindu boy. They should have left him in peace, and he would have developed himself freely in India, and his work would have been marvelous. The great Buddha of Krishnamurti did not give his whole message because his bodhisattva had a psychological trauma. If we examine the doctrine of Krishnamurti, we see that it is the best of Buddhism. Unfortunately, that at its best, it is Buddhism. Unfortunately, he did not know the Christic esotericism. The Hindu body drank from the fountain of the Buddhist gospel. It is a pity that he did not know the Christic esotericism. Later on, he mixed the Buddhist philosophy with the conventional philosophy from the Western world. Thus, the doctrine of Krishnamurti is the outcome of that mixture. The doctrine of Krishnamurti is Buddhism. However, the doctrine of Aquarius is the outcome of the mixture of Buddhist esotericism with Christic esotericism. The doctrine of Krishnamurti is free Buddhism. However, the living fountain of that doctrine is the marvelous gospel of the Lord Buddha. We are not against Krishnamurti. We only regret the fact that the internal Buddha of that Hindu philosopher could not give the whole message. That is all. When a clairvoyant discovers that the innermost, the spirit of someone is a master, it is best for that clairvoyant to be silent, in order not to damage that person. When somebody knows the inner being is a master, he becomes filled with pride and arrogance. Fortunately, Krishnamurti knew how to be humble. There are also fallen bodhisattvas. They are worse than demons. No one has to be told that his inner being is a master. The clairvoyant must be prudent. The clairvoyant must learn how to be silent. Okay. And then, yeah, just at the end, Harry says, the fights and errors of the Theosophical Society were the cause of the trauma of Krishnamurti. The Krishnamurti case is very important. So I just share that because, again, I just think it's kind of a fascinating chapter and just relevant because it just such an intelligent explanation of this really kind of interesting, you know, teaching and philosophy we have of Krishnamurti that was always so mixed. And then also, again, just shows, it really highlights that relationship of the bodhisattva and the being. And if we have that power, those skills, like that samurai, if we have that sword, we have those skills, we have that bravery, we have that training, then what we really need to do is let go of the ego and to not disconnect from our being and our master and to really learn how to be obedient, to learn how to listen to our being, to learn how to just have that relationship and have that communication, because it can be dangerous to go off. So that brings us to the topic of the fallen bodhisattva, the Hanusmushin. And the Hanusmushin word came out with Gurdjieff, part of that ancient language. He talked about it as a being with the double center of gravity. And some will use that term, or the term the fallen bodhisattva. That is that Ronin, that rogue warrior kind of thing. So it's the fallen bodhisattva has the astral, mental, and causal solar bodies, but hasn't died in the ego. And then there's different levels of it. Samael talks about sort of different levels of Hanusmushin, but that's the essence of it. So we have this situation of the fallen bodhisattva coming into the world with a lot of karma, a lot of complication, and then kind of these strong drives and abilities. Often there's, you know, a certain level of clairvoyance, there's some astral abilities, remembrance of past lives, maybe an attraction to just esoteric or occult things. But at the same time, like this also at the same time, like a lust or a big strong pull towards life and materialism and things like that. So again, like we may or may not objectively in terms of the bodies that we actually have built, those of us listening, you know, are technically a fallen bodhisattva or not, but these are still relevant. just it's relevant to know, just because guaranteed we have ego and we have essence, that there's still going to always be these pulls. The essence is always going to be yearning to awake, to do the work, to have that serenity, to have our consciousness collected and strengthened within the essence, to be in communication with the being. And the ego, of course, is just wanting to go external and to look outward and to have the desires fulfilled. But I have a few excerpts from a really nice blog out of Australia, the Esoteric Study and Work Aids. And there's a couple of really great points about fallen bodhisattva that I'll quote here. So one is, within the fallen bodhisattva is resentment towards God. So it's on this deep level, this resentment towards God. And the blog, this person wrote, because of the pain of the fall, they resent God. The fallen bodhisattva resents God and feel deep down that God, their inner being, should not have let them fall. And now working on themselves, they suffer, dissolving the egos and paying karma. And they know it's for their being, but they resent that they have to suffer for the being who is happy and free. And we know that the being is not happy and free when we're fallen. We're a heavy burden for him. Okay, so that's just very interesting. Like, again, I'm just going to use that samurai analogy again. It's like, you know, for to have a fully trained warrior at that level, a lot of investment has gone into that. A lot of training, a lot of time, a lot of resources to have a person at that high level. And same with someone who has created the solar bodies. Like, there's many, many teachers and groups and practices and support and struggles and investment from the being to arrange things just so that essence can find the teachings and to do the work and maintain it through however many lifetimes. And so if that all that investment is going into a fallen way and moving away from the being, ultimately, that, you know, it's a burden in a way. It's weird to think about us being a burden for God, but that's, you know, it's kind of a reality. So that work is, and then the work, of course, is burdensome for the bodhisattva because the ego is a little bit more complicated. And with those types of resources, you know, internal resources or psychic abilities and things like that, I mean, someone could have a pretty fun life, you know, just not doing the work and just kind of using those abilities to just be famous or get rich or just all these things, you know, have a lot of charisma and so forth. So that's just a really interesting insight that I found, that of like, there's kind of this resentment towards God, even in the work. And, you know, we can reflect on that to see if we relate to that or not. And then there's another little part here about the expression of the ray. So like the expression of the cosmic ray. A fallen bodhisattva has to express his or her ray. So even if they are not working for their self-realization, they'll be physically working in the field of their ray, fighting for a cause which has to do with liberation, justice, education, equality, awareness, knowledge of their fellow man, etc. Usually when a fallen bodhisattva enters the domain of the work on him or herself, so like the Gnostic work, they leave the physical expression of their ray and enter the spiritual expression and teach or fight for humanity through the spiritual aspect of that ray. For example, Master Samael was asked, where would he be if he was not working on himself or not gotten his self-realization? And he essentially answered, I'd be in the mountains with a rifle fighting for the liberation of men. So a fallen bodhisattva of the ray of law might be a lawyer or a social worker, etc. Then if they're in the Gnostic work, then it would be more about teaching the mysteries of the law, understanding the mandates of the divine law. So again, I just thought that was really, really interesting. And so Master Samael, coming from the ray of force and doing his Gnostic mission in a really strong way with that like fiery Mars energy, and then knowing that about himself, that if he wasn't actually channeling that, putting that into the Gnostic work and the mission, then he'd basically just be in the mountains with a rifle and fighting for the liberation of people. Like our ray expresses on some level. So yeah, so that's interesting. And then this blog here, it goes on to say, and this is something I've also heard before, that so this is, you can take this or leave this, that at this point, you know, in this late age we have of the Kali Yuga, if we're in Gnosis, there's a pretty good chance that we're a fallen bodhisattva. So you know, you have to verify this for yourself, of course, but it's, you know, it does kind of make sense. Like the time is getting near to where things are going to be shifting in terms of where the civilization is at, and the teachings are very complete. You know, like if any of us have looked outside of Gnosis and kind of seen what else is out there, there's things that may look and sound like they're talking about this or that with self-realization or this or that or Kabbalah or something over here, something over there, but nothing is so incredibly cohesive and complete and actually giving us the tools here and now to actually do the work. And that is something just really unique, and that it's openly being taught. It's here. If we're here, we're in it, we're working with it. Then there's, for one reason or another, you know, potentially because we're a fallen bodhisattva, there's some urgency. And there's some urgency to really do this path and to really die in the ego and to really align ourselves with our being. Okay. So that's the bulk of my talk, but I do want to end with some more from the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, the Shantideva. And it was tempting to try to just read, and I know I've read a lot of quotes already, but and it's tempting to read just like this whole chapter, but it's really long. So I encourage you all to read it or to find it. It's easy to find online. It's at the library. It's published as either A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life or The Way of the Bodhisattva. And I'm just going to read again from that dedication. By the force of my virtues, may those caught in the fiery torrents of acid, their flesh eaten away, revealing their lily-white bones, obtain the bodies of celestials and dwell with goddesses in gently flowing rivers. Why are the henchmen of Yama, the unbearable buzzards and vultures, afraid, through whose noble strength is joy brought upon us and darkness dispelled? Looking up, they behold in the firmament the radiant form of Vajrapani. Through the force of their joy, may they be free from evil and find his company. When they see the lava fires of hell extinguished by a rain of falling flowers mixed with scented water, immediately satisfied, they wonder whose work this was. In this way, may those in hell behold Padmapani. Friends, don't be afraid, but quickly gather here. What need is there to flee when above us is the youthful Manjugosa to dispel our fears, the tender Bodhisattva who protects all living things, through whose might all suffering is removed and the force of joy abounds. Behold him in an inch, sung by 1,000 goddesses, with the tiaras of 100 gods being offered to his lotus feet, and a rain of many flowers falling on his head, the eyes of which are moist with kindness. Upon seeing Manjugosa in this way, may those in hell cry out loud with joy. Likewise, having seen, due to the roots of my wholesome deeds, the cool and sweet-smelling rain falling from joyful clouds, created by the Bodhisattvas, Samantabhadra and Sarva Nirvani Vishkambi, may all beings in hell be truly happy. May all beings be free from the fear of being eaten by one another. May the hungry ghosts be as happy as the men of the northern continent. May they be satisfied by a stream of milk pouring from the hand of the noble Avalokiteshvara, and by bathing in it, may they always be cooled. May the blind see forms, may the deaf hear sounds, and just as it was with Maya Devi, may pregnant women give birth without any pain. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find new hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their illness, and may every disease in the world never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting one another. May all travelers find happiness everywhere they go, and without any effort may they accomplish whatever they set out to do. May those who sail in ships and boats obtain whatever they wish for, and having safely returned to the shore, may they joyfully reunite with their relatives. May troubled wanderers who have lost their way meet with fellow travelers, and without any fear of thieves and tigers, may their going be easy without any fatigue. May those who find themselves in trackless, fearful wildernesses, the children, the aged, the unprotected, those stupefied and the insane, be guarded by beneficent celestials. Okay, so that is the dedication, and I really hope that this helps us understand a little bit more about the essence of the Bodhisattva and to maybe reflect on it a little bit more, and hopefully this is helpful for everybody. So at this point, I can take questions. You can go ahead and send them into Karate Radio. And thank you all for listening.
Thank you, Carly. That was The Mysterious Path of the Bodhisattva. And we will be back after a short break with your questions. Okay, we are back with your questions. We have 5 questions for you, Carly. And we'll go to the first question. We're not necessarily going to do them in the same order. However, since we see that the questions are pretty similar, we're going to put them in a different order in which we received them. So we'll go with the first one here. It says, my question is, what would cause a bodhisattva to fall?
Okay. So what causes us to have a spiritual fall is going to be a sexual fall. And Samael is really specific about this, and it's the transmutation of the sexual energy, making that deliberate, intentional choice to move the energy inward and upward, to renounce the orgasm and to renounce sensation, and still be having the sexual energy move and circulate. That is what brings about the, you know, the elevation of the sexual energy and the awakening of the consciousness. And then the fall is always going to be a sexual fall. And that can be going along with certain egos. Pride is a really big one too, but it's the actual physical mechanism of the sexual energy going external into sensation with the orgasm is specifically what causes a fall. So yeah, so it's pretty specific in that way. And of course, any fallen bodhisattva's whole story of how exactly and when that happened and how and all the different egos that led up to that is going to be unique. But I mean, that's the path of the razor's edge. It's pretty much either going up or going down. Yeah, so and that's the basic answer to that question. But I'll expand on that in related ways when we answer the other questions. So Anibel, do you want me to read the other questions?
Okay, so let's move on. Should we all strive to be bodhisattvas if it is ultimately the will of our innermost and not the human personality? Not all are called to be bodhisattvas. Where can we find our place on this path?
So that's a really good question. It's a really interesting thing because that's like we're doing this work and trying to become in alignment with the will of our being. And it is the being that's making these decisions. Like our personality isn't really making the decision about the work. Like there's the teaching about, you know, at a certain point in the initiatic path, choosing between the straight or the spiral path. You know, in the process of learning about this and discussing it with my teachers at the time and with other students and all this, like we're like, will I choose right? Will I choose the direct path? How do I know? But it's something that the being chooses. The being is that chess master who's making those choices. So, you know, we're always just trying to be awake and conscious enough that we are moving along with our eyes open to know what we're doing and to be, you know, to just like have cognition and consciousness about where we are on the path and what we're doing and why. But that aspect of conscious will is something that it's the being coming through to make those decisions on that level. So the work is the same. Like the 3 factors are still the same and they're still necessary for all of us, and all the aspects of just trying to integrate the work within our life, within our circumstance, and to die in the ego, to transmute our sexual energy, and to work for service and sacrifice for other beings, that is all the path. And there's not really anything we can, because the question says if we should strive to be a bodhisattva or not. So I know the talk was about kind of being inspired by that intention of renouncing nirvana. And I would say that that intention is, in its purest aspect, it's a Christic aspect, which is the work we're trying to do. That's in alignment with the 3 factors. So in a way, like, yes, in our intentions, we should strive to be sacrificing ourselves for other beings and look to the famous enlightened bodhisattvas and Christic masters that do that work and gain inspiration from that. But ultimately, yeah, it's not going to be our human personality that decides what we do or even how that looks. So, and then that last part of the question, where we can find our place on this path, it's continually unfolding. Like if we're doing the work, even if we feel like maybe we're doing it somewhat imperfectly, or we don't think it looks proper, but if we're sincerely working in the 3 factors and having accountability, then we're doing it. And then it just unfolds from there. So I hope that helps. I hope that answers your question. Thank you for asking that.
Okay. And the other one, is there a practice that we can do to help develop the bodhicitta? Can we envision the health, well-being, and enlightenment for all to help develop this aspect?
So I think for a lot of my answers are starting to just going to be doing the 3 factors. So we're on the right track if we're working on our ego on some level, which can just be observing ourselves, denying that ego, its manifestation, actively comprehending, working on it, meditation, spiritual discipline, attending the activities in our group, reading Samael, all these things, transmuting the sexual energy, working in sexual alchemy if that is an option for us, and loving the being, being in our heart, circulating that energy, and service for others, sacrifice for humanity. Again, those are the three factors that is going to build the bodhicitta overall, because remember, the bodhicitta means that seed. So it's that sexual, spiritual seed that we cultivate through all those things I said, the three factors, but we certainly need transmutation. We need sexual transmutation in order to have the bodhicitta, and that with the work of awakening the consciousness, which again goes hand in hand with the death of the ego, that is how we cultivate the bodhicitta, envisioning the health, well-being, and enlightenment for all to help. I mean, I think like having those prayers that are actively praying for other beings, I think that does help. I think it helps to open our heart. It helps to connect us to that feeling of love for all beings. You know, the simple Buddhist prayer, may all beings be happy. May all beings be joyful. May all beings be in peace. And really feeling it when we say that and imagining. And I absolutely love these passages that I shared, and much more that I didn't have time to share in the way of the Bodhisattva, because he just, you know, goes on and on and like so specific, like all these beings burning in hell, let rain shine down upon them. Let, you know, people who are traveling and lost, let them find their way, and just, you know, kind of like going through every predicament of suffering that a being could possibly go through, and imagining and praying and wishing for that to be remedied. I mean, that is helpful. And then, you know, we have that in our, like our practice, our own practice. And then of course, trying to practice that as best we can, just out in the world, and how we help and serve people in the world will also just be just individually what we feel called to, and what we feel like where we can best be. Doesn't necessarily have to look like running a charity or something like that, but it might. I mean, you know, just having that intention to help people. So it's that combination. Like, and I think I'm actually going to sort of answer another question just to answer this question, which was about just examples of how to sacrifice for humanity. So sacrifice for humanity, and sacrifice is basically charity plus the death. So yes, you know, being charitable in some way, shape, or form, whether that's just an act of kindness on a big or small scale, plus the death of the ego, because there's certainly ways to just get caught up in, like, you know, being nice egos and trying to just help out kind of egos, and it's not really that helpful, or just all these ways that can get kind of maybe mixed up. But like, you know, with a sincere intention to help people and then dying to the ego, that is a sacrifice for humanity, and that helps to build the bodhicitta, and then of course the transmutation. So I'm sort of repeating myself, because it really does boil down to the three factors. But yes, I do believe that having, you know, bringing in some of these, as you say, the envisioning the health and well-being of others, praying for others, coming from a place of as much consciousness as possible, that is good practice for walking in the Christic way. Okay. Yeah. Thank you for that question.
And last question is, if we find ourselves resenting God for reasons described in the common earthly attitudes of a bodhisattva, what can be done to remedy our anger or pain?
And that's another really good question, because that is such a deep level of work. Even to recognize that, you know, within the work that we're resenting God, and just that in itself, I think is really like just to kind of know that and to be able to see that in ourselves, like there's a level of kind of repentance in that, just to be able to be with that. So yeah, so if that's something that's coming up for us and feels kind of poignant and feels relevant of like resenting God, I mean, again, of course, the three factors is like just the overall overarching thing, but you know, the practice that there's lots of different practices I really love, but I love the mantra, the Om Mani Padme Hum mantra, and that's of course related with the Bodhisattva of compassion. And so kind of like I've just found a lot of force in that mantra in dealing with difficulties that I've had and just like feeling disoriented and confusion. And it kind of brings this big wave of compassion that's just so much bigger than like my particular problems and even you know, me feeling like I'm trying to solve other, you know, the suffering of humanity's problems by myself kind of thing. And that mantra and that connection with the universal compassion is helpful. And yeah, and then I would just say, just taking that into your work. Like, if you can see and hold and be with that, knowing that resentment against God, and have some comprehension and have some repentance, then it can really transform that. And I think it can also really bring a lot of compassion and understanding to other people who feel that way, because we have complicated relationships with the being, with God, just because we have these complicated minds. So yeah, so just try to find serenity, try to find that equilibrium, and try to investigate that particular ego, I would say. Yeah, thanks for that question.
Okay, Carly, we have no more questions.
Okay, I think I answered all of them. Yeah, thanks for everyone who listened and who sent those in. And yeah, thank you, Annabelle and Elio, for having me again.
Well, no, always a pleasure, Carly. Thank you for coming back with Coradi Radio. And I understand you're doing a roundtable pretty soon with Scott, Diana, yourself. So we're looking forward to that activity.
Yes, definitely.
Something new for you, something different.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, all. Well, thank you for your participation also, for sending us your questions, and all who are just listening there and will listen in the rebroadcast. Thank you all. Take care. And until next time.